Hello and welcome to our show. You are listening to WART, WART Radio, 98.7 in Washington State. The time, if I didn't mention it before, is 7 o'clock, which means it's time once again for the Uber Elite Hacker Force radio show. Pre-recorded this time, as always, in a restaurant. It is the 4th of July, and I'm in Stillwater at the border of Minnesota and Wisconsin to watch the fireworks here. The fireworks here are especially fun. I went here last year with a friend. This year I'm alone, but I'm waiting for my cheese curds to come to keep me company. In this episode, we're going to be... unfortunately, we're not going to be releasing anything, but I'm going to make it up for you by interviewing a couple of people. We're going to be interviewing Crew about his Cabbage Flash, a flash cart for the ColecoVision, in addition to Matthew Jones about his work with the D programming language, or more specifically, the projects that he has written using it. But before all this, a musical break.
Well, next we have a medley of three movie scores, all really dramatic and gorgeous. This is music from Batman, Dances with Wolves, and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Welcome back, everyone. Again, this is WART, Wart Radio. You are listening to the Uber Elite Hackerforce radio program. My cheese curds have arrived, and a very delicious cheeseburger as well. Let me hold the microphone up to them so you can hear them. And see them. Don't they look delicious? I think they look delicious. So this is what I'm going to do. Instead of doing radio and eating at the same time, which my mother tells me is impolite, I will get back to you after the bell. Welcome back. It's now an hour into the future. That bell may not seem like it takes a while to bell, but brings you forward in time. And those in the background are the cannons. My cheese curds were just too delicious. All-American food, an all-American holiday, and all-American people. It's kind of like pride, but for straight people, to be honest with you. Not a queer soul in sight. Makes me feel a tad nervous, but that's okay. I still have a great deal of fun here. So, now for the poem of the week. And last week this was an essay. And this week it won't be an essay or a poem, it's going to be a thought. Because essays take a while, right? And poems are not very poetic, right? So, okay, here's the thought of the week. You have complexity. You have computers, and you have an idealized sort of... The idealized computer is the Turing machine, and the Turing machine has memory. It has program memory, an internal state, and an external state, this external state being a tape, right? And you can theorize from that complexity of what it computes. It can compute anything, but the complexity of what it computes is in some way proportional to the memory that it can store. But this has never been proven. The halting problem still exists, and you can't definitively prove what a program will actually do. But it's a good guess that you can say that the complexity of a program is related in some way to the amount of memory it either stores or the amount of program memory it reads from. And so how is this stored? Well, this is stored in the real world. We have magnetic flux and capacitance and these things. Because the world is physical, and this computer is in a physical world where it's constructed. And it computes using physical things, more or less. And so, how complex is what it computes? How complex is the memory that goes through it? We have a number that is made up of 22 ones and zeros consecutively, 10, 10, 10. You would need a 22-bit number to store that, right? But you can store it in a smaller number by, say, 1 followed by binary 22 or binary 21. Plus the program to expand that. That program might look something like, take the first bit, inverse it, decrements the number you're taking from it. When it reaches zero, you're done. And store it in the leftmost position for each iteration. And so you've expanded a smaller number that's not 22 bits. Let's say it's 6 bits. I don't know offhand what binary 22 is. But let's say it's 6 bits. I think actually would be, 5 or 6 bits, plus the 1. So we've reduced a bit that's 22 bits to a number that's 22 bits to a number that's 5 bits. So how far can this go, right? Well, again, this computer that is constructed and runs in a physical world, and this physical world supposedly is based on the Big Bang, where you have expansion of existence, more or less. An expansion of energy and matter and these things. And all the complexity of the world comes essentially from this Big Bang. So essentially, you could reduce the size of this bit to the size required to the storage size of the universe, either at the Big Bang or before the Big Bang. I suppose at the Big Bang, which is for all purposes just infinite. You can compress things infinitely, provided that you have the time to do it. Now, it took the time in the universe to expand from the Big Bang to where it is now. So it could take a while, right? This 22-bit number is not going to be nothing for a good while. But what are we doing there? Are we actually taking the complexity of the universe and compressing it back to the size of the Big Bang? Is this actually possible? That's an interesting question, I think. Because you're told to think that the matter, that disorder comes from order constantly, that things are constantly becoming more and more disorganized. And you've heard this 1,000 times. I'm not going to talk about Schrodinger's cat. You can Google that. Quantum mechanics and all these things that you've heard perverted over and over again. But the essential problem there is the observer that changes the probability of things being observed. I think, okay, take this. This is... Okay, sorry about that. My battery died, and now I'm here in a somewhat secluded room that says employees only next to an outlet. Shh, don't tell anyone. So as I was saying, here's an example of this thing that you've been told about over and over again that you can do. It's fairly simple. You're all geeks, right? And so you have an LCD, and you have two polarized filters, one horizontal, one vertical. Then you have a sheet of liquid crystal in the middle, and this liquid crystal polarizes the light that passes through it by 90 degrees if a charge is going through it. It doesn't if not. So you have something that becomes opaque and something that becomes clear with current. And so take one of these filters, cut into three pieces, and have one so all light coming from it is, say, polarized horizontally. Then put another one at a 45-degree angle right next to it, so it's polarized at a 45-degree angle. And then have another one over that that's polarized at a 90-degree angle. Now, you'd expect that pretty much no light would come through. You're filtering out all lights that is not horizontal, and then you're filtering out all light that's not at a 45-degree angle. Then you're filtering out all light that is not at a 90-degree angle. So why should any light come through? Well, it turns out that's not what happens. What happens is it goes through the first filter, right? And then that goes through the second filter. And what the second filter does is change the probability of light being filtered by the third filter or not, so that it isn't probable at all that no light that can't be filtered by the third filter goes through. So when the third filter comes, all the light goes through. And so the filter that's polarized at a 45-degree angle makes everything clear, which is really messed up. And that's what we mean by the observer changing things. And so why does this happen? Going back to complexity, can we take a complex universe and make it the Big Bang? Can we take all this expansion and compress it with just us? And you would think no, but you know, maybe this is not true. Like, I think that would be one indication that this is not true, that the very act of observing something by a species or something that can then has the probability of reducing the complexity of this thing change the universe, I think maybe an indication that we can. Now if the universe were going into a big crunch at the end, and we're just expansion followed by compression, just if we expand, stay still, and compress, like how the old theory was, then I think this would make sense. But the universe is expanding exponentially, so why? Why would there be a movement of the universe to, in some way, be compressed more? I don't know. It's a big question for me. Okay. So, back to the regular program. We were going to have a release this episode, but it's not quite getting there. This is called Hack the Planet Term, which is a terminal emulator that I've been working on. And so you're in a terminal most of the time. And it's pretty boring, right? Like, if you're super late, maybe have a Wise Amber terminal. But chances are you don't. And so it needs to look more like you're hacking the planet, in my opinion. So this is what this terminal is meant to do. I'm going to release it next episode. But if you want, you can check out a video to see the progress so far at the Uberlite Hacker Force. It's all one word, deepgeek.us. Now on to the interviews. Our first interview is with Crew of Block Party fame. And at Party Fame, he's a fellow demo scener, and we're going to be talking to him about his ColecoVision flash cart. Then after that, we're going to be talking to Matthew Jones. After talking to Matthew Jones, hopefully there'll be enough time left for you to watch the fireworks with me. That's my point here. I'll be right back after this interview. Hey Crew, how's it going? You have made a flash card for the ColecoVision, so I hear.
Yes. It's called Cabbage Flash. I released it as a wild entry to that party.
Yeah. And apparently it's USB mass storage. It looks like a mass storage drive to OSs. So it's pretty cool. It seems to be OS agnostic.
Yes, one of the things I wanted to do when I started making it is because I'm not good, or I don't really like making interfaces on my whole side. So I wanted to have something that I could just plug in and copy data, and so that storage is a really easy way to do it.
And so the ColecoVision is a Z80, as I understand. How much memory, how big is the card?
Well, there's 32 pin, that's what I use. There are some newer bank switch cartridges, but right now the main cartridge that I'm using is the standard 32K, and the reason for that was, I basically created, Cabbage Flash because I wanted to test out some cards. A demo that I did for Block Party, and one of the constraints I found myself for making a demo was to make it fit in a standard cartridge, and because there were actually no commercial games released that were even larger than that, I think the video game crash happened before companies could start implementing things that you might get into the Atari.
So the Atari was would you say the Atari is the first console to have bank switching? I assume this is within the cartridge, some sort of bank switcher of higher bits in the cartridge. Would you say the Atari is the first to do this?
Was it the first? I'm not really sure on the history. I know it became really common because the Atari only had 4K of address space. And I think it's 4K. So, and plus people were designing games a lot longer.
Yeah.
At the time, Rico was around, I think it came out in 1982, there were, 32K was enough for anybody, basically.
Yeah, it's 32K is quite a bit for back then. So that's cool. You don't have to deal with a lot of different chips. Should you want to, well, okay, what's your primary, audience for this? Is it homebrew developers, or do you think a lot of people are going to dump their ROMs onto it and plan a real system?
It's mainly homebrew developers. There is a flash card that's being produced. I can't remember the name of the company, but I can give it to you later for the show notes.
Okay.
Very nice method. And they have a flash card, and it stores, I think it has 128 slots, and it has its own graphical front end and its own proprietary USB protocol.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of gamers who like to release cartridges. And this is a very big thing where the game developers and the game players, they like, especially a lot of more collectors, so they like the real cards. They like manual box, especially. So a lot of the games that are being written today, people are making manuals and paying out cardboard boxes and shipping them that way.
Did you, your block party, production was, Waterline. Is that right?
Yes.
Did you have any box art for that?
No, I didn't. I'm not as interested in that stuff. I didn't want to pass out a physical card, so what I did, I did design a label for it, and I had, an embroidered patch.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to do the same thing for the year before for the Sega Genesis. I was putting together this demo, which never really came together because I decided to do too much of it at the end. Like, I had all these effects and I wanted to put them together, but I didn't have the cash for an EEPROM programmer, which is the route I was going to take as far as so. Oh yeah, I remember. It's cool. You also have a number of other things. You have an AVR synth, I understand.
Oh, right, yep.
What else are you working on?
What am I working on now? Well, there's still more ColecoVision stuff, but nothing in particular now. I think the way I did it in general on Waterline was I just coded a bunch of effects, and once I thought of a theme, started tying together, so I had to hit it again.
Mm.
This is a weird story. It's still related to Waterline. Is that there was an old name I remember from my Apple II days, like a while ago, and he had linked to it. I think he had seen it on somebody's Twitter or whatever. And of course, I'm looking for it as soon as it was released to see what people have to say. And I came across his blog entry, and there's like an Apple II conference. And so every year in Kansas City, and I'm going there now. So I'm starting to unbox all my Apple II stuff and getting involved in that again.
Sweet.
And then what else? More synthesizer stuff. I have a network synthesizer. A modular synthesizer with all the pitch cords and that.
Yeah.
So I have this idea about a network modular. It's not my original idea.
How do you mean network modular?
Well, instead of patch cords, there is a bus. I'm using the CAN bus that automotive networks use.
So you're sending events over a CAN bus? That's pretty cool.
Right. So when you plug in a module, it reads an ID, and then it has a certain number of input and output ports, and it announces itself to the front panel, and then you can use some interface on the front panel to connect.
Is that a pretty fast port?
What's that?
I'm sorry, is that a pretty fast protocol, the CAN protocol?
It's not too fast. It's 1 megabit. As far as the maximum of the specification, some networks, it's possible to run it faster.
That's not bad, though, 1 megabit for MIDI-ish. So I'm assuming you're doing something like key events or something like that.
I'm doing, like, control signals over it. So audio is switched in some matrix separately. But control, so it's more than just key events. It's like if you have an LFO, it's going to be outputting its control voltage, equivalent onto the network.
Ah, I see.
So it's more really like modules. So when you have the signal of the modulators and all that,
Are you planning, are you thinking about having a bunch of different physical modules for this and like a separate LFO? I don't know. I'm wondering, is there a certain sort of textual sort of feeling you're trying to get for this? Or why not just have it entirely on a computer?
Yeah, I don't know why. It's the truth. It's one strange thing about hobby projects. You just do what you feel like doing. Part of it is because I like building things. I want to incorporate some analog. that, you know, I know there are a lot of people who would not even like this project because it doesn't, you know, it contains some visual parts, you know.
Oh, really?
I'm not that strict, but it is a lot easier to do certain things analog or a lot more fun to design circuits that way.
Yeah, yep. Interfacing with a computer for synthesizers is the sucks. At least I think it is. Like, it's incredibly difficult to move two knobs at once, for instance, which is kind of an important thing, unless maybe you have a couple of mice or something like that.
Right. And, yeah, and that is a big problem. Like, when the DX7 came out and all these FM operators, and how do you control it? Make a patch now, you have so many things in control. And that's like the hardest part of this synthesizer is because now you don't have a dedicated knob on each module because the boards are all controlled on the network. So how do I map them to up and on the front panel and how does, can I make that work? I don't know. I'm going to try.
Now getting back a little bit to Waterline and the ColecoVision, what kind of graphics chip does the ColecoVision have? Yeah, either can I.
9918. It's the same graphics chip in the MSX1.
Huh.
If you would know, you probably know the Sega Genesis has like a superset of this chip.
Yeah, I think it does. It's probably for master compatibility.
Yes,
or something
exactly.
Of that nature. So it's not a bad chip. 1982. That's better than the 2600, right?
Yeah. Well, there's some things that are better and some worse. There's a lot less you have to do.
Yeah.
Compared to the Atari 2600, but then there's a lot less control you have. Because with the Atari, you basically have to draw each line as it happens, and you can configure things while it's drawing. This chip, you don't have as much flexibility.
Hmm.
So, but I mean, still, it's a lot more sophisticated.
Yeah. I mean, you have a reasonably slow processor. I mean, well, what is it, like 3 megahertz or something like that, or 4 megahertz?
4 Rico?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the color frequency of NTSC, which is
3.14, no, 3.7? Okay, what is
three
it?
3.5, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
The weird thing about the Rico is to save money, they clock the processor, the video chip, and the worst part is the sound chip.
Yeah, that's hilarious. It's all clocked to the chroma frequency. That's pretty funny. Now for the 2600, mind you, you could buffer a frame line and scan line, and you have a lot of control that way. But it seems like it was such a slow of a system that the control that you could utilize from that didn't outweigh the amount that you could do with sprites. You know what I mean? Like, there's some tricks with sprites, and if your processor is fast enough and you have that capability, you can pretty much get away with something that you can do on the 2600. For instance, maybe changing addresses per scan line or something of that nature. Are you doing any tricks with that? Are you doing any sort of horizontal scan line tricks or anything of that nature?
Oh, raster stuff?
Yeah.
On the Clico, not yet. The Clico doesn't have a scan line interrupt. There are ways that you can sync to a scan line that there's like a collision detection flag, and you can set up two sprites on one scan line, but then you have to pull some bit in the video chip to tell when it happens.
Mm.
And then there's another one you can't have any more than 4 sprites on a single line, so if you have more than that, then it's a different flag is set, so you can essentially identify two separate regions of the screen by checking those bits. I didn't do anything like that yet.
Is there any way, out of curiosity, does the sound chip produce any interrupts or anything like that?
No, that's one thing about the the only timing available is the vertical retrace. So you have 60 hertz clock, and that's it.
Yeah.
So any other timing, I mean, if you want to use cycle timing, you know, to measure it that way, you can. But all you have is 1/60 of a second.
It was pretty impressive waterline, to be honest with you. I know it was recently put on PIAO, despite it being released for a year or so, and it seems like everyone really enjoys it. What was what's your favorite effect out of waterline, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, my favorite? I don't know.
I guess you could say they're all your favorites. That's a valid response.
Yeah, I'm not really sure I can say it with that.
So, have you, the mass storage device is 32K. Have you noticed any bugs in any operating systems, with that small of a size?
Oh, it was hard to design at first because, implementing the USB code because, I mean, anytime something wrong happened, I would assume it was my code.
Yeah.
There wasn't any big bugs that I saw, if you look in the mass storage spec, all they do is say, here's this, how do you put on some command, and here's how you send the response back, and that's it. And then they have IDs for what the different types of commands could be. The most common is just SCSI command. And so in SCSI, you can give addressing is done in terms of blocks and or sectors, and you have to specify your sector size and how many sectors the device has. And if you say anything other than 512 bytes, bad things will happen, basically.
What controller are you using?
It's an Atmel controller, the AVR series, the same type of core as in Arduino. This is a version that has the USB controller included.
Have you heard of the Igor plug? Out of curiosity.
I think that's pitching software, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty wicked project, I think.
I remember, it was either that or there was some other software implementation I did some other experimenting with a while ago.
Oh, seriously? You have done your own implementation of USB?
No, I haven't. I mean, I did some experimentation with some other AVR.
It was an AVR, you say?
It was an AVR, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, my only experience is with the ML89C5131, which is a 8051 type controller. And so I was working on this keyboard thing, right? And so I was implementing the human interface device protocol. And, you had mentioned before, like, a lot of the times when you would encounter a bug, you'd think it's in your code. And there's a particular bug. Oh, my God. I haven't fixed it. I've debugged it so much. I'm pretty sure it's not my code. I'm pretty sure it's FreeBSD is the operating system that I'm accidentally crashing my kernel with whenever I use it. With that. So, you know, maybe it is my code, but I haven't, like, it's starting to get in that little fuzzy area where I'm getting a little bit frustrated with it. Man, how long did it take you to get USB mass working?
Oh, I don't know. It just takes me a couple months for the project completely. I mean, spread out over maybe 4 months. I did the hardware as well.
Yeah.
So I designed the circuit board and started working on the software. Basically, I work on software, you know, on bus ride. Some front work, so I can't say how much time I actually spent, but it was pretty much a couple months of free time.
Are you selling your, are you selling boards or anything like that, or are you just releasing the design?
I don't really want to sell boards. I got ruined by that in the past.
Oh, really?
Yeah, trying to, you know, some people say they want a board, and okay, I make some big order, and then nobody has, you know, I set up a stack of 50. If enough people want to, I mean, I'll organize a group purchase so things are cheaper for everybody.
Yeah. Now, how are you leasing this? Are you, is this GPL'd or under some other license, or have you, how are you releasing this?
So right now, I guess it just falls under copyright.
Yeah.
Not licensed at all.
Yeah, that's kind of usually how I am, to be honest with you, too. Cool beans. What kind of development did you do before your cart? Or you had said you had mentioned that you had another cart as well, a more expensive one. Have you done any work on emulators or anything of that nature? Or what kind of work have you been doing before with the ColecoVision? That's cool. I think you won wild, right? Or you won old school.
Old school demo, yeah. they were considering integrating wild, but didn't like they did previous year.
Mm. How did you feel winning? Yeah. I'm sure it does. So if people want to get a hold of you, how can they contact you? Is there anything else you'd like to tell people before we leave?
Oh, well, how long we got?
As long as you want. I was just concerned because the battery was starting to die here, so I guess if you cut off, we'll say our goodbyes, right? But why? What's up?
Well, it was just one other thing, like when I was making cabbage flash, one of the things I wanted
That's annoying, man. EEPROM programmers? Oh, my God.
First of all, it takes a long time to erase them.
Yeah.
The other thing is you can get ones with sockets, maybe, or you have to solder them in, so you can't make the cartridge until you're done, basically. And if you're at a demo party, you know that you pretty much are not done until, you know, 5 minutes after the deadline.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to be soldering
Yeah. What's the old saying? Test early, test often, or something of that nature?
That sounds like a good saying.
All right, I gotta let you go. Thanks for the interview.
All right, good talking.
Yeah, you too. Okay, the sky is getting a bit darker, and soon the fireworks will be out. Before that happens, hopefully Matthew Jones can take us to that time. Enjoy this interview. I'll be right back after this recording. I'm here with Matt Jones, who is actually a D programmer. Now, I know nothing about D, D being the computer language, not the grade, D programmer, right? But so, hey, Matt, how's it going?
It's good. Nice to be here on the show.
Well, thank you for coming. We appreciate it, of course. Could you tell us what D is about?
Well, basically, D was created by, I think the guy's name is Walter Bright. He runs Digital Mars. They make a bunch of C and C++ compilers, and I guess over the years of making them, he really kind of got into why those languages are good or bad, and he just decided to make his own language. And that's where D came in. And I think it was created first in 1998 or 1999, but it's still pretty unknown.
How did you get into it yourself?
I think it was maybe 2002 or 2003. I was in university, and we were doing, I think it was C++ or C with Microsoft Win32 libraries. Terrible. And I was just looking around on the internet, and I don't remember how I found it, but I found the Digital Mars website, and I was reading up on it. Got more and more interested in it over the years, and I didn't really use it till maybe 2007, 2008, when it got a little bit more stable, supported.
Could you tell us some of the most obvious differences? What are some of the differences that you noticed? You said you had experience in C++. Well, what were some of the differences that you noticed right away?
Let's see, the most...
Is it anything similar?
It's pretty much like C++ do-over, I guess. So it takes C, and it adds a bunch of new stuff, and it refines some other stuff. So, for instance, you don't use pointers. Instead, the arrays are just much smarter. Like, they know their own length, and you can resize them. And, like, if you slice an array, you get, like, a subset. If you change the slice, then it'll change the original array. So it's a lot more helpful with you having to use pointers. But you can still use pointers and all that low-level C stuff, but you just don't have to. So it's still, it uses the same ABI as C. So when it's compiled down, the binary format's the same, so it works just like C. There's classes, operator overloading, you can do inline assembler if you want. The templates, they're not like C++ templates, they're really complicated, they're more like mix-ins where you deal with like Ruby or Python or something. There aren't any macros, so they have some static statements where you can do like a static if statement. They have built-in unit testing and built-in design by contract. Garbage collection is by default, but you don't have to use that. You can just use, you can do other memory management yourself if you want.
Yeah.
Those are some of the most obvious things I can think of off the top of my head. The problem with D is that the primary compiler, it's the Digital Mars DMD compiler. It's proprietary. So, that's why it hasn't really been adopted on, say, like Linux or FreeBSD or whatever. But then, I forgot who did it, but someone created the a GCC version, but it's not actually in GCC yet. It's called GDC, the new D compiler, and it's been kind of ignored over the past couple of years, and it's every time there's a new release of GCC, they have to patch it and make all the stuff, try and get it to work. So that's been kind of drifting. But there's a new compiler called LDC. It uses the new LLVM-based backend, so it's not based on any GCC stuff. And that's really, really promising. That's what I've been using, and it's very nice.
Mm.
The primary library, like, it was called Phobos, and that was also proprietary and done by the Digital Mars people. But there's a new project called Tango, like the dance or the icons, where it's actually really good. It's a really good library. It's similar to Phobos, but I think it's much better. Like, it's much more efficient. But again, it's not, let's see, the only distro, I think, the Linux distro, I think, that actually has LDC or Tango in it is, I think, Debian and Ubuntu. So, the packages are kind of broken.
Here, let me,
okay.
Let me check OpenBSD right now, since I'm right here, to see if this is a package. No, it doesn't look like it's in the ports tree for OpenBSD either.
Oh.
Aw.
Do you know if it's hard to get new packages in there? I'm not that familiar with the BSDs.
No. As long as it's reasonably ported to a BSD of some sort, it's I mean, the ports tree is maintained by the people who maintain the distribution of OpenBSD, so that's not likely to change by your own means, but you can build your own packages if you want, or you can just build your own programs without adding them as packages, but it's not terribly difficult.
So I was thinking...
I don't know. You'd have to contact the... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just thinking of trying to get more stuff packaged. Like, I was working on a Fedora package so I can get it in the RPM distros, and maybe someone can get it in BSD and so on. Because once that happens, it should get a lot more...
Well, you'd have to talk to the ports maintainer.
Yeah, maybe I'll do that later. I was actually, after you initially emailed me, I was trying to figure out how to get it going on the... I think I was using OpenBSD, but I didn't have much luck with that.
So you have a number of projects that you've written. Are they all in D, or could you tell us about some of the projects you are working on?
I mean, I have a bunch of projects that are various stages of usefulness or toy projects. The only one that's actually in D would be the Rootin' Tootin'. It's like a web framework, like a Django or Ruby on Rails. It only works with MySQL right now. And there are some issues, like if you use the latest Tango from a trunk, because they haven't released it, or they need to do a new release, there's problems with the regular expression, so it's extremely slow to, like, compile it and then start it up and then wait for a request to process. But, I mean, are you familiar with, like, Rails or Django or any of the other web frameworks?
No, I'm not.
No?
No, what? Was this a practice for you, or were you feeling some sort of functionality that you felt was lacking? Or, Rootin' Tootin', why did you start this?
Kind of both. I mean, right now I'm doing... For my day job, I do freelance web development, so it's pretty boring. I mean, I'm usually using horrible things like ASP.NET and people's kind of homegrown PHP stuff and making these boring intranet websites, so I like to work on other stuff in my spare time. I've been using Rails, too. If you're not familiar with Rails, it's like a new kind of web framework with like a model view controller style, and that's pretty much what all the other new frameworks are doing. They're kind of copying it. Well, not copying, but doing the same thing. But Rails is usually a little bit ahead.
Model view.
Oh, the model view controller. Mm. It just means that the data and the logic layer and then the presentation layers are all separated. So it's not like one giant function that like looks up the database stuff and then renders the HTML and just like how most PHP websites are usually done nowadays. So they try and separate it all. And Rails is good. I mean,
I see.
Yeah, it's hard to explain without showing like code and examples and all that. Like Django is probably the second best one, and then there's like. Oh, you had a question?
Oh, I was just going to comment that it actually sounds like a kind of an exciting thing to work on. It sounds like almost like an operating system of sorts. But go ahead. What were you going to say?
Yeah, there's a lot to it. It's kind of daunting the amount of work you have to do to get it to work, but it's fun. And I mean, Rails is probably the best of new web frameworks. Still, even though it's probably like 5 or 6 years old now. But I mean, there are still problems with it. Like, if you don't, like, Rails assumes that you are going to have caching turned on. So that means that when someone makes a request to your website, it has to run a bunch of Rails, Ruby code to talk to the database and generate the HTML and all that. And if you don't have caching on, it's really slow. It's like 7 requests a second slow. I mean, and if you're comparing that to like PHP or Python frameworks, they'll probably get about 200 requests a second. So it's a lot slower. And let's see, what other problems do I have?
And is it better in some sense? Do you think? Are you solving a problem that you've seen with these frameworks?
Yeah, I mean, it's designed to take everything I've learned about those other frameworks and kind of make them easier. And most of the problems with those frameworks is that they require you to do a bunch of extra steps to do the caching part. And that's like a huge pain in the butt, where it's like when one person hits the website, it saves all the HTML as in the cache, so then when another person hits it, it won't have to actually run any other Python or Ruby code. It just returns the static thing, or the static HTML. And having to do that is kind of a pain in the butt. So the kind of core idea behind RittenTutton is that if we just write it out all in D, it'll be a lot faster, so we won't even have to do any caching. I mean, I've done some basic benchmarking, and I mean, it's still pretty much a toy, and it's very unstable, but it gets around like 8,000 requests a second, which is a lot faster. I mean, that's the kind of you really won't have to worry about caching until you get to be a really huge website like, I don't know, Dig or one of those super huge websites or Twitter. So that's kind of the core idea.
To be honest with you, it's always surprised me a little bit that a lot of these programs that are being run on web servers aren't written in something faster. Like you say, D is just inherently faster, so therefore caching is not so much an issue. A bunch of scripting languages that people are writing these in, PHP, I mean, I don't want to belittle the complexity of that language by any means, but it doesn't strike me as the fastest thing in the world. And if speed is an issue, I mean, I'm wondering, what do you think, you sort of being immersed in this world, why do you think it is that that faster languages haven't been utilized for these things? Is it portability or ease of making things easy to read? Or do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, primarily, you have, like, the scripting languages, like Perl, PHP, Ruby, Python, that are usually much slower, but they're really easy to use. And then you have these kind of partially compiled languages that use VMs, like Java, .NET, Mono, C#, VB, and all that. And then you have the native code, where you have C and so on. And up until recently, you didn't really have that many options as far as popular languages to use. So now you have things like Fala and D. And it really kind of opens the door to getting an easier-to-use language that has garbage collection, and you don't have to write header files and all that. So, I mean, if you go up to the average developer and you say you want to make a website in C, they think you're crazy. And I think that that kind of combined with the whole, I don't know, it's not misinformation, but I mean this kind of idea that people won't think, or they think that unless you're using something like Java or C# or Python, you're not going to be able to get garbage collection and all that stuff with native code. There's this kind of idea that if you're using native code, you have to sacrifice things like that. It's like this kind of paradox, like garbage collection and native code? What language is that? Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, that answers my question a little bit. So... you have Rootin' Tootin'. Is there any other projects that you care to mention?
That's pretty much the only D one. I mean, I'm also porting the Python Tornado web server to D, so then I can get an asynchronous web server. So then I don't have, because if you're making a web server, you pretty much either have to do it asynchronous or you have to use threads. And over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of effort with Tornado and what's that new one? It's written in JavaScript. It's Engine.js or Node.js and so on to not do the thread thing, instead to do the asynchronous thing. So other than that, that's pretty much all I'm doing in E. I mean, I have a bunch of other projects, but they're all like toys and stuff.
So Matt, is there any direction that you want to lead the conversation? Is there anything else you want to talk about in particular?
I don't know. What else you want to talk about? Geek stuff or some other? Well, aren't you really into things like, what is that? Those demo things where you make like a demo that runs on like a Genesis or whatever, like graphic demos.
Yeah, I'm a little bit into that.
Have you?
Why do you ask?
Been using anything like OpenCL or CUDA or anything like that to do kind of similar stuff on regular PC hardware, or you just stick to mostly like game consoles and so on?
Mostly just overall, mostly just C and OpenGL, as far as any sort of thing on the PC is concerned. Otherwise, just C and an assembler, and that's mostly what I stick to as far as languages are concerned.
So you haven't done anything?
Do you have any experience with...
I've done a little bit of OpenGL and assembler and stuff, but that's not something I spend a lot of time on anymore. I was just wondering if you had any experience with it, like OpenCL and that newer stuff, CUDA and so on.
No, to be honest with you, no. I'm kind of, I've noticed that I don't like to have a lot of, I don't like to branch out very much. Like, I don't like dependencies. I don't like branching off into languages that aren't standard. I'm not saying that these languages aren't standard by any means, but I'm kind of a single trail sort of person. I'm not sure if you understand what I'm getting at. May I ask why, though, you're asking about these in particular? Do you have any experience with these?
Oh, I was just looking at the previous episodes of some of your shows, and I noticed that you talk about that kind of stuff, and I was wondering just specifically if you had any experience with some of the OpenCL or whatever, because I was trying to get that to work a couple months ago when I didn't have any good luck with it, wondering maybe if I was running something different, like one of the BSD-based systems, I'd have more luck. But I haven't found anyone who's really messed with stuff that hasn't been using Windows, unfortunately.
Thank you, Matt Jones. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Thanks for telling us about D. Hopefully some of our listeners will be excited about getting into this sort of seems to be forgotten language, as you say.
Hopefully that would be great if more people heard this and spent some time looking into D and trying it and so on.
Do you have any contact information that you want to leave us with?
So if you want to look at some of my other stuff, you can go to my website, workhorsey.com, or .org, sorry. That's workhorsy.org. And then my email address is on there. If you want to check out Rootin' Tootin', you can just look it up on Launchpad or on my personal site.
Okay, I'll put those in the show notes. And take care, Matt.
All right. Bye-bye.
Welcome back. We are just in time to be out of time. We've reached the end of our program. Up next is the BSD Action Show. We'll catch you next week.
Public Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.